Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dr. Maish Seibel, founder of drseibel.com. And today we're going to have a discussion that's near and dear to everyone's heart and soul and body, and that is about sex. And we're actually going to talk about something called accessible sex, and I'm going to allow that to be defined in just a moment. And I'm going to tell you that we have a distinct pleasure of talking today with Dr. Mitchell Tepper. He is a sexologist, and he has been dubbed by some the prophet of pleasure, but I'll let him talk about that as well. By background, he is a summa cum laude graduate from Bryant College, and he has a Master of Public Health from Yale University, and a PhD in human sexuality from the University of Pennsylvania. And I want to jump right in on this and just welcome Dr. Mitchell Tepper. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
It's absolutely my pleasure. And I think that by virtue of understanding later on about some of the things we're going to be talking about, it might be helpful for you to give us just a brief history, a little bit about yourself as a person, because you have some personal experiences in addition to the exceptional academic ones that make you an authority and someone who's highly passionate about the area that you're involved in.
Sure. You know, you mentioned the prophet of pleasure, and that name is because I feel that the work that I'm doing now is my calling, and for so long I was doing it, you know, without getting paid, because I just loved it and wanted to share what I'd learned. I started off, with a dream of working on Wall Street. In my family, I was the first in my family to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
My father thought I should be an accountant because that I could go work for the FBI and retire when I was
40. It's always a good business.
Do whatever I want to do. And I was a renegade. I majored in finance instead of accounting. But during that time, I broke my neck between my junior and my senior year of college. And I did that as a lifeguard, and it was secondary to surgery I had. I grew up with Crohn's disease, so I have a lifetime experience with chronic condition.
Mm-hmm.
Crohn's disease, like an inflammatory bowel disease, a lot of cramps and diarrhea. So I grew up, on medication and in hospitals, and eventually had some surgery, which left me with an ileostomy bag, which is like a bag that collects feces, and the doctor said to me, "Don't let this bag keep you from doing whatever you want to do." And I'm like, "I want my job back as a lifeguard." And so, I rehabilitated after getting out of the hospital. I was like about 110 pounds, I believe, when I left the hospital. And
so, just to get this straight, you were a young guy, around 20. You were a lifeguard. You also had this debilitating chronic illness, Crohn's disease, an inflammatory disease of your intestines, and that resulted in some surgery on your intestines, and meant you had to go to the bathroom, have a bowel movement with a bag. But you didn't want that to interfere, so you were going right back to being a lifeguard.
Yes, I did. And so, the doctor signed my permission slip, and it was like one of the first weeks back, instead of working on Long Island Sound, where I usually was positioned. I was at a lake, Lake Mohegan, and it was just near the end of the day. I was going out to fix a buoy, asked somebody for a surfboard, and the woman told me I didn't need it, and so I didn't bother. I ran out with one tool in my hand, it was in my left hand, and I dove over a rope that separated the deeper end of the lake, and I just kind of did a flip. And I usually would just do a flip and move on. But at this time, the water wasn't as deep. I'd gained a lot of, muscle weight, but I wasn't, used to my new body. And I had one hand in front of me, so that one hand wasn't enough to keep me from head planting. And my head went into the bottom of the lake and heard a noise and floated to the top. And that resulted in a C6-7 spinal cord injury. So quadriplegia, or eventually I was incomplete quadriplegia.
So you weren't able to use your legs, and you had some use of one of your arms, I think.
Correct, yeah. I had one heart, my left hand, I had what they call a gross motor function, and my right hand was not very functional. I had what they call tenodesis. I could bend my wrist back, but not grasp my fingers.
So this is a very long way from being a sexologist.
Yes. I met my wife after I met her briefly before I broke my neck, but I met her after when I went back to school, so I kind of missed a year. And so she thought she was marrying somebody heading towards Wall Street and ended up with a sexologist. So, mm-hmm. It was a journey.
Well, it sounds like that circumstances were what they were, and you went about a journey to educate yourself, and as a byproduct of that, you wanted to educate others as well, because in this country, there are millions of people who have both chronic diseases and who have disabilities, not only spinal cord injuries, but other kinds of chronic illnesses and disabilities that make it very challenging for them to be sexually active or to view themselves as sexual beings.
Yeah, and when this happens to somebody, whether it be traumatic injury or illness, and they experience any type of change in their sexuality, that could include body image. You know, there's a result of scars or treatments or removing of limbs, mm-hmm. body parts. It could result in a lessening in their response because of side effects of medication. It doesn't matter what the change is. People begin to feel like less of a person, less of a sexual person. And they begin to, avoid that area of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, women that I've done research with spinal cord injuries have told me, I put that on the shelf. I didn't want to deal with that. I didn't want to deal with another loss. And that can end up being problematic, one, if you're already in a relationship and you don't work on ways to maintaining that connection. And two, a lot of people can feel lonely, and feel like they're not worthy of being in a relationship. So it may hinder somebody who's single and wants to be in a relationship from engaging in a relationship because of shame, guilt, embarrassment, all those things that anxiety keep us from anger, from connecting with other people.
So sex is not, a sexual relationship is not only about the sex, of course. By definition, part of it, but it's also the intimacy, the closeness, the sharing, the really getting close to another person in many kinds of ways. And what you're saying is that you want to help people who have any kind of, whether it be a scarring or a disfigurement, or whether it's of medications that they're on that are numbing them in some way emotionally, right, or physically, or whether they have been traumatized or had a traumatic injury in such a way that they have physical loss of limb, you want to enable those individuals to be whole and to have a sexual experience as part of their life, which in your opinion is achievable.
Absolutely, and that's what I mean by accessible sex.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about accessible environments, sidewalks, stalls, ramps, and I want people to understand that sex can be accessible too. I mean, even in the case where, I work with combat vets, and if someone lost their genitals in an explosion, you would assume, I have no penis, therefore I'm not a man, my sex life is over, and it doesn't have to be. So even in the most direct ways in which people could be injured, in the most literal sense in their sex lives, that we can, not have that define their whole person, their whole being as being a man and as being able to please a partner and also to be pleased.
It's interesting because in the 2012 Olympics in London, we saw a runner from Portugal who had lost both of his limbs.
Yes.
And with artificial limbs, which were at one point even felt to be an advantage. They weren't sure they were going to let him run because he would have an unfair advantage, not a disadvantage. he made it to the finals or the semifinals and inspired the whole world about what can be done. And this is at an Olympic level. He was running past people with basically no feet. I mean, he had artificial prosthesis that enabled him to participate. But still, here's a guy who was able to go and accomplish a very great thing. And what you're trying to say, and what you are saying, is that, you know, we have to look, we don't have to think of sex as an Olympic event, but it's an event that we all want to participate in, and that the loss of what is considered the traditional equipment for it, whether that's physical or emotional, doesn't prevent us from being an active and successful participant.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you begin a discussion with people? Let's talk about accessible sex. And what we're going to try to do is incorporate in our conversation, I want to try and talk about it in the more global way, not just from a person who has the kind of injury that you sustain, but also the category of people who feel removed from it because of illness or because of chronic conditions or trauma, whatever. Would that be okay if we talked a little bit about it?
Absolutely.
How do we get started? Someone comes in, someone is worried, someone doesn't know what to do. They're sitting at home, they're listening to this discussion, and they're thinking, well, gosh, now maybe this is news to me. I mean, I thought I was done, I was finished, or certainly hasn't been satisfactory. I haven't known what to do, where to get started. How do they get started? What do they do?
Yeah, so when someone comes to me, people often assume I'm a psychologist because I'm a PhD, I'm a doctor. But my PhD is in human sexuality education. And I taught in medical schools and other health professional schools. Mm-hmm. And I've taught directly to people with and without disabilities. I volunteer in my son's high school. And so generally, most of us don't have a formal and a good education in sexuality. So I start with the basics of, you know, systems that contribute to sexual response and expression. And I give them the basic rundown on what happens to their body when people get aroused.
Can you tell us this very just in a very capsule way? Can you give us just like the cliff notes on that?
Sure. You know, two physiological functions happen. We have blood flow and muscle tension, right? And so Masters and Johnson, these sex researchers, studied this in the lab. So when we get excited, we have an increase in blood flow. Most notable for men would be an engorgement or an erection. For women would be lubrication and engorgement of the clitoris, increase in breast size. So the blood flow makes us feel warmth. It makes us feel like tingling. It creates more sensitivity in different parts of our bodies that might not have been as sensitive before the blood started to flow. And then there's an increase in muscle tension. And that release of tension has been associated with orgasm for men, the contractions with ejaculation, and for women, mm-hmm. the contractions with orgasm. And so this process of increase in blood flow and muscle tension and these secondary changes and warmth in the body and your hair standing, the sex flush, all these feelings or sexual feelings. So what I begin to do is help validate these other feelings in people's bodies and sexual feelings.
Other feelings being what now?
Warmth, tingling, mm-hmm.
The ones you mentioned.
Uh-huh. An increase in breath. I didn't mention increase in breath and heart mm-hmm. rate, but I talk about that with, you know, your heart is beating faster, you know, and you begin to breathe more. And
you're excited.
These things are signs of excitement. And just because you may not have sensation left in your genitals doesn't mean that you're not being sexually aroused, and that we could learn how to amplify these other sensations and not to focus on what's missing.
Mm-hmm.
So, because that's I think the hardest thing. It's like when I ask people, tell me how your disability or your condition affected your sexuality, they say it's not the same, it's not normal. And what's the same and what's normal for people is what was same or normal before their accident or before their illness. Mm-hmm. So it's the most difficult, one of the most difficult challenges is comparing with the past, you know? And so then I help people put this in context and some people see me many years after and see, okay, you're working, you have a family, you've done these other things, you're getting joy out of your life, you do athletics, whatever. It could be the same in your sexual life. You just have to be open to it. So I try to point out, you know, what areas of success they have in other areas. And through education and all, bringing, you know, real stories of other people. And often, you know, I work with groups and do psychoeducational groups and mm-hmm. teach some of the basic relationship skills. And people learn from each other, too.
What are some of the relationship skills that you talk about? Because clearly what you're saying, it's in a way, I mean, this is going to seem very trite, and forgive me if it is, but I mean, you could just lose your job, and you did something for a long time, one thing you did, and that's how you saw yourself, and then suddenly you lose your job, and so you got to retrain yourself to do a new job, a new
right.
skill. And while I, please understand, I totally get that this is not about anything like that. What I'm trying to use just simply as a metaphor is that sex was one way before, and before we got the medications, before we got the cervical trauma or the spinal injury, or before we had the cancer that left us in that set of conditions, and you know, we're going to have to learn a new set of tools that may be different, but can still be highly successful and highly satisfying.
Yeah, and you know, what we talk about, you know, post-traumatic syndrome, right, PTSD.
Right.
But, you know, a few people talk about post-traumatic growth. And through the process of what I call sexual self-discovery, through education, through becoming more literate, sexual health literacy, being more able to talk about both your function, your response, your feelings, and also, well, your feelings in a relationship, and to share those, your fears and your hopes, people could actually come to have a richer sexual life, and not just cuddling, a richer sexual life, a richer, you know, orgasmic experience. So, you know, there really is so many, you know, people, we have, you know, national studies that give percentages of people with quote-unquote sexual dysfunctions at 43%, and they don't ask enough questions to actually call them dysfunctions, but I think we have a lot of sexual boredom.
So 43% of the country has a sexual problem, not talking about the kinds of magnitudes that we're speaking of, but you're just saying in general, two out of five.
Those are numbers that have been thrown around based on a national study.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at people who report, you know, low desire or pain,
right,
or erectile dysfunction. Yeah, and this is a national representative sample. It's not that. And I'm not saying that they all have dysfunctions. I'm saying it's put in the media that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have problems, concerns, or, you know, just...
They're not as happy with sex
boredom.
As they could be.
Yeah. I mean, I just yesterday saw Hope Springs. I don't know if you saw it yet.
No, it's
Tommy
a movie
Lee.
About an older couple with...
Yeah, it's Tommy Lee and Meryl Streep, and they go up to Maine for a retreat for a week. But they're basically in a sexless marriage, you know, for many years, where they hadn't had sexual relations in 4 or 5 years. And you know, that's after, you know, they're married 31 years, and Meryl Streep forces him to, not forces him, but buys a ticket and gets him to go for therapy. And so here's, you know, a couple... You know, who at one point, you know, he hurt his back and started living in an extra bedroom, and then never went back into the bedroom with his wife, and they began to disengage sexually. And when that happens, people sometimes stop touching, they stop kissing, they stop caressing, and then each party, you know, begins to, you know, have anger that's not expressed.
Or it comes out in ways that's not intended necessarily, or
it leaks out, you know, and sarcasm and all different types of ways. So
what I want to ask you, though, is what people want to know is, okay, they're sitting at home, they realize that maybe we've touched on something that's them, and they want to know, how do they start? What do they do? How do they move the ball, the marker, move the chains down the field? How do they get going to get going?
Well, if they, you know, first, I mean, they could come visit, you know, the site, MitchellTepper.com. I had a website for 15 years, sexualhealth.com, which is now still running and owned by another company, and they're doing more STD, HIV testing. But some of the content is still there, general content on sexual functions and relationships. And so one is to study up a little bit online. Go to the bookstore.
Where do you go online? The online is such, you know, there's some good information and there's bad information. Are they reliable?
Well, I mean,
your site, just to make sure, is Mitchell Tepper, MitchellTell, T like Tom, EPP, P like Paul, TEPPER.com. And that site has a number of articles on it, and I've looked at it. And also, it's an interesting video of your son, which we're going to come to in a little bit. When he was younger, talking about growing up with a sexologist dad and his experience, you know, explaining disabilities and things in a way to kids and letting kids come into play and understanding. That we're going to talk about later. But so what other sites do people...
Well, I mean, sexualhealth.com is, there's, you know, it's all expert-generated content. Reliable content, great resources.
Is that help, H-E-L-P, sexual help, or health? Sexual health, H-E-A-L-T-H dot com.
Right. And so that's another great resource for people to go to and start.
So start with like everything you do, get educated.
Right. And then contact someone like me, or I'm also an ASECT certified sexuality educator and a counselor. So that's the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, AASECT.org. And many years ago when I was, and I'm still involved with them, but when I was involved with their web communications, I helped set up our national referral list. So you can go and click on, you know, for the public and go to a map and look for ASEC certified sexuality counselor or therapist in your state. And so, if there's not someone near you and you don't want to do it over the telephone or over Skype, what I recommend when you're looking for any kind of counselor or therapist to help guide you through this, and if you're in a couple's relationship, and there are sensitive things that you don't know how to share without hurting somebody, it helps to have a mediator. So so you can go look at what the requirements are on ASEC. You know, you could go into the professionals thing and see what type of training is required to be certified in these various categories. And I say just print that out, and when you call, whether it be a marriage and family therapist or licensed professional counselor, anyone who holds himself out as is doing some of this sexual type of work, I would ask them, you know, depending on your issues, how much, you know, education have you had in chronic conditions and disabilities and sexual response cycles and gender and orientation, depending on your issues. And so we have how many hours and how much experience that requires that we think people need for us to give them certification. And so in helping to find the right person to help you, because people could just, you know, they come with very little training. I mean, I've spent my career doing medical education.
Saying is, in all areas of medical help, especially in paramedical kind of stuff, there are people who are qualified and there are people who say they're qualified. And you have to tease that out. That's your job as a person. So your first goal is to get information, and you can get that either from sexualhealth.org.
No, it's .com.
.com. Sexualhealth.com, or you can go to MitchellTepper.com. You can go to AAS, like Sam, EC, like Charlie, .org. That's the...
ECT. Last word is therapist.
Say ECT.
AA.
AASECT.
Right,
.org. Okay. So you can go to there, which is an organization that's involved with the actual people who are... most qualified in this area, find their criteria. So now So first is get informed. So you got to do a little work. Second thing you got to do is find someone to work with to go beyond and start making changes. And then what?
Then it's implement that changes with you in your life, you know, whether it's on your own and, you know, taking that next step of reaching out, looking for a partner, or if it's with your partner, you know, and engaging them in the process and taking a risk and moving forward with trying something that you might be, you know, quite anxious and frightened about.
So you're dividing this into people with partners and people without partners.
Well, sure. I mean, each person is in a different space.
Right. And for women, I mean, for men, there are obvious things. How might women, I mean, sometimes you've been a certain way and you've been withdrawing for a long time. Men see they don't have an erection. And I mean, that's not the only, you know, we talked about the breath is going faster and the heart is beating faster. And we talked about the body is warmer and there's engorgement. Men see this stuff because it's much more physical. Something changes. It's outside the body. But for women, how do you let women know? How do women say, some women may have been in a situation for such a long time, they've just crossed it off their list, you know, as you just said. And how might they plug back in? How might they even recognize that things turned off? How do people identify these things?
I think they know that things have turned off. It's just a matter of not wanting to deal with it, not wanting to make it a priority. And, you know, every person, you know, it depends. I mean, if you've had a lousy sex life before, right? And you can look at erectile dysfunction, or you could look at, you know, dryness, painful intercourse or something as a reason to stop, right? So, you know, I talk about regaining that feeling, and you know the question is, did you ever have that feeling, right? So, you know, it's
gaining the feeling.
Well, you know, hopefully for most people, it's regaining that feeling. But if you're, I mean, sex happens, and let's talk about the context of a relationship. You know, not all relationships are great, and sometimes not all sex in relationships is great, and people don't share that with each other, and they endure bland or even painful sex, and they're looking for an excuse to get out. So, you know, and so they're not mourning, they're not missing. But if you're mourning the loss of something that made you feel good, made you feel whole, made you feel alive, and you want it back, then you need to kind of take things into your own hands, because, you know, and I know that, you know, doctors aren't going to make this a priority when you go in, you know, for your follow-up exam, you know, after your...
Well, you've got to tell the doctor you have a problem, because doctors have only so many minutes to talk with
you. 7 minutes to take care of you. And, you know, if you're coming in because you just had heart surgery, you had bypass surgery, you know, these days with medication, well, now there's concerns as far as with heart medications and oral medications, but they might ask you and offer you a pill. But beyond that, if that's not... working, you know, so many pills are sitting on shelves, right? Because people just give up. You know, they just don't want to deal with everything.
Let me ask you this: what about timing of things? You know, what about the timing? If things are not ideal for people, how do they go about? Is there anything to do with their scheduling, for instance, when they decide to have sex?
Oh, of course. I mean, quote unquote, traditionally, people have sex at night before they go to bed, and you know it's the time of the day when you have the least energy, and that may work, you know, when you're young, and they may do it in the context of after watching TV or something like that. So when you know if that's you know fatigue is an issue, that's not going to be the best time. So it might be waking up early. It might be on a weekend. In the morning, and maybe in the afternoon, if you could steal some time on a weekend or during the week, depending on your schedule. So I would encourage people to try to make a date around a time when they have their highest energy level,
I've even told patients of my own sometimes, I've told them to actually rent a motel room like they did when they were young and single. And even if they don't stay there overnight, and even if they have a kid and they have to get a babysitter to come, just go for dinner, go to the motel, and then come back home. I mean, make it happen and create,
create that purposeful space.
Exactly.
Purposeful space, purposeful time. You know, and there's the myth of spontaneity, you know, that all sex has to be spontaneous. But you know, one of my professors put this in perspective. He said, you know, when you were, you know, a teenager and you went on a date, you knew it was Friday night, you were going out to dinner or a movie, and you had to have her home by 11 or midnight. So you knew that between 10:30 and 11 or between 11:30 and 12, that's when you're going to be trying to get your sex. And he said, so sex is like the most planned activity in history. So, you know, we learned from the media that, you know, we're just going to drop what we're doing in the kitchen and do it on the counter, you know.
I thought they went for the counter in the kitchen. If there's any time left over before 11, then they had something to eat.
Maybe that's what they should do.
So anyway, so number one, you want to get there. You want to, so you're going to get informed. You're going to get someone to help. You're going to schedule times that work for you when you're energized or your energy is available. And this is true whether you have disabilities or just inabilities. And then how about medications? How do they play in? Everybody's taking something today.
Well, okay. So, I mean, there are medications. It's always a discussion that you, one, have to bring up with your doctor. If you notice changes in your sexual response or function secondary to medication, then you should bring up with the doctor. And then there's always, you know, for like mental health-related issues, there's a trade-off between feeling depressed and feeling sexual, and there could be adjustments in your medication.
Are there some medications in particular that are known culprits that people should be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into specifics. We've always talked about like SSRIs and different antidepressants. And
well, I'm not taking, don't name a brand specifically, but just just the, you know, ones that.
I mean, there are categories of antidepressants and hypertension medicine, and even, I don't know what you call it in Jersey, but even like Sudafed, that you would not naturally think of affecting you might affect you. So,
well, it can certainly make women dry,
right. And dry leads to pain, and so, you know, if you're in that category of drugs, so there are a lot of, you know, sexual pharmaceuticals that are, you know, have negative side effects, and some of them you just need. I mean, and you know, also treatments for cancer. I mean, they just totally wreak havoc on your hormones, and when your hormones are out of balance, that wreaks havoc.
They make you tired too.
On your response, yeah. So you know,
what about people who are in pain? You know, who are dealing with pain as part of their health condition, their medical problem.
You know, the thing about sex is that when you're aroused, it's a natural analgesic. And so what we try to do for people with pain, same thing about scheduling. There might be times of your day when you have less pain, and also with positions, there might be positions when you have less pain. So first you have to understand your own pain, and then understand how your medication alleviates or reduces that pain. And sex, we plan to take that medication, you know, if it takes at least 30 minutes to kick in. We try to plan that medication to take that medication so that you're as comfortable as possible at that time when you begin to engage in your sexual play. And that may even be, you know, for some people it may be a warm bath, you know, to relax them. Mm-hmm. Other people with MS, a warm bath may knock them out.
You can start the foreplay and take a warm bath or shower together.
Yeah.
Potentially.
So really you have to kind of, you know, get to know this, and you have to be a problem solver. You know, you have to look at things, or you know, on the other way, you have to be creative. Know yourself, and say how, you know, when am I most comfortable, and then when you begin engaging in the activity, you know, that pleasure that you feel sometimes helps. You know, forget about the pain for a few moments. You know,
it numbs the pain.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you have women, you have genital pain, and sex aggravates that pain, we want to help take care of that, and that's a whole separate discussion. That's a whole separate discussion. Well, that's actually your expertise, right?
Right. As a matter of fact, if on my website on drseibel.com/menopause, we have whole videos on just sexual pain and the discomfort that comes with that, and that will be a subject of other interviews. But but you also talk about how some people have problems with sphincter control, and it's with people with illnesses may have problems with their bladder or bowels and so forth.
Absolutely. So, stress incontinence even after pregnancy, you know. So, you know, when people have problems with sphincter, bowel, or bladder control, that creates, you know, worries, anxieties, and that's definitely to be worried and anxious is not the position you want to be to enjoy your sexual life. And so if you're worried about that, one, you know, manage, you know, the timing between what you drink and when you have sex. So, you know, you don't want to start in a full bladder, so you want to empty your bladder first. Same with your bowel. Definitely, you know, you may not want to eat the spices, foods, or things that aggravate you before. You want your partner to know that, you know, maybe you're uncomfortable, you know, in this area that an accident might happen, so that it doesn't totally take everybody by surprise. And then, you know, for folks when this might happen, it's really, I mean, with urine, there's nothing dangerous if it leaks. And there are people who are into water sports, you know. So there are people who actually like that. But, I mean, for practicalities, we say have something waterproof under your sheet or under you. Have a towel next to you, a urinal if it's something that you can empty your bladder and then move on without interrupting.
It's kind of like if you had an interview, you know, if you were preparing for an interview, you're about to go in for an interview. And I don't want to.
Yeah, no, I did the same thing before I talk. I did the same thing before you called me. I went and cast, you know, so I use a tube to empty my bladder. So,
Think you have to think of this because a lot of what we're talking about is really planning. And it's planning because there are special needs. And so if a problem is going to be, you know, having the energy, you schedule a time when you can have more energy. If the problem is going to be discomfort or pain, you take something for pain. If you're taking medicines that impact on you, you want to try and minimize those or at least talk with your doctor about the impact it's having on you sexually. See if there's alternative medications. If there's problems with bladder or bowel problems, you want to take care of business before you get down to business. And then you're talking about other things you've talked about, like you don't want to be where you're freezing to death or sweating to death. You want to get an environment that's comfortable. Nobody wants to get naked when they're freezing, etc. And then for some people, because of circumstances, some positions are going to be better than others.
Right. And so what I help to try to do is kind of take the taboo away from talking about sex and look at sexual health as part of your overall health care. So we look at your mental health, your sexual health, your physical health, your relationship health, and get people to, you know, say, hey, this is part of my health, part of my wellness, how to take care of myself. And I have every right to ask questions and explore this area and enjoy this area of my life as to go to work or to do these other things.
I want to say, too, that if you go to your doctor and you have issues about sex, the doctor that you see may be the best cardiologist in the world or the best orthopedic person or the best whomever. But they may or may not either, A, be as knowledgeable about sexual issues, or they may or may not be as comfortable with sexual issues. And so you want to be able to go in and ask these questions and ask them at the beginning of the appointment, because if you ask about something that's special, intimate, that takes time when you're walking out the door, it isn't going to get any attention. But what you can get is one of two things. You can either get a referral to someone who is a specialist, Or you can go and look up further the kinds of things, the AASECT.org, and find individuals, et cetera. Or you can schedule a follow-up appointment with your doctor if he or she is comfortable and competent in these areas, where you can sit down and they know what you're going to talk about. You know what you're going to talk about. And then you go in when there's time and you can really explore these things, because this is critical. You can't rush through these conversations. They're awkward, uncomfortable, a little anxiety provoking. And why maximize that part and minimize the outcome?
Right, and absolutely, they often, these things do come up as people are walking out the door, because they're on their mind, but the doctors aren't asking it right up front, and you might ask a general question in the end, and they bring this up, and that's the suggestion that you said I hear from a lot of docs that are comfortable addressing this. Yeah, let's make a separate appointment, you know, come back, and that's what we'll talk about. What do you want to focus on? You know, we'll have this much time, and we can focus on that. And so in this environment, our healthcare environment, it's you know, very challenging.
It's going to get harder, so be proactive. Right. And what about spending time, you know, in other sexual things, that, you know, like building that moment up with intimacy and erotica and things? How do you talk to people about that?
Absolutely. I mean, sex shouldn't start in the bedroom or with the activity. I mean, it starts from, you know, being nice to each other during the day, doing each other favors. And then, you know, when I talk about other activities, you know, you might have read the article on Tantra on my website.
So that's funny. Instead of friends with favors, this is favors with friends.
Absolutely. Yes. So
be nice to each other.
Be nice to each other. Understand what, you know, one way of referring it to the five languages of love, or the love banks, you know, understanding what has currency for your partner. So sometimes we have a tendency to do things for our partners that we would like done for us, both in giving it. So you might give expensive gifts when your partner really wants, you know, 60 minutes of your undivided attention.
So if I want to be really nice to my wife about something, I shouldn't say, you know, there's a great baseball game going on or a great football game. I really want to make sure you don't miss it. Maybe I should ask what she wants, in other words.
Absolutely. Like, I know, you know, when my wife's schedule is busy at night, and so if I take time to go with somebody to the grocery store so she doesn't have to, mm-hmm. you know, I know I'm putting money in that love bank.
There you go.
And if I sit down and watch some TV show with her that I really don't care for, you know, I'm putting money in that love bank, and she knows the different things that she does for me that I appreciate. So that keeps things going, and I think people should touch, hug, hold hands. You know, those things.
Be physical. In other words, don't be afraid to be physical. You don't have to be intimate to be physical.
Right. It doesn't have to.
You have to be physical to be intimate, but the reverse is not so. And that can sort of, you know, among the yogis, they're always talking about, like, you know, 48 hours of foreplay. And some cultures, they will begin touching and et cetera with no intent of anything days before. What about other things that you I've heard you write about or seen written about, is oral sex or other kinds of communications that you can do to really enhance the opportunities? And
well, oral sex, when I talk about talking about sex, or oral sex as in fellatio and cunnilingus?
Well, and however you would communicate to people what they could be doing.
Well, I mean, one thing, when it comes to alternatives to intercourse, let's talk about that. So everyone thinks about intercourse being the goal of this thing, penetration, and where, you know, two people, and I also think of the simultaneous orgasm and all these other fancy things, which are nice. But, you know, if, say, you know, somebody comes to me, they have fibromyalgia and they have this pain, right? And so it may be taking turns, and it may not even have to be on the same night taking turns. So on one night that you give your partner a massage, and if it's a woman partner or whatever, you stimulate her manually and orally, and you don't get on top of her if weight bothers her, and you know, she's in a position that's comfortable for her, and you're just pleasing her and you know, and just paying attention to her. And another night she could please you in whichever way that you want. So it doesn't always have to be, you know, I don't want to use the F word on the radio, but it doesn't always have to be, you know,
a mutual, right, or intercourse.
Right, mutual going at each other, and which can be fun too. But I'm just saying that this is the model that we know of. I basically talk about the Western model of sex, which is a friction model of sex, which is you rub the right area for the right amount of time, the appropriate stimulation, and that's going to lead to pleasure and orgasm, versus the Eastern or the energetic model of sex, and a lot of those things that you were talking about, whether it be Tao or Tantra. And so we look at the body as an energy system, and that we could learn to cultivate this energy, share this energy, and that energy doesn't require us to, you know, use our physical bodies at all. So people are able to use breath and sound to get into a, you know, an orgasmic or any kind of a state of bliss, you know, that it's described as. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are many, many vehicles. So some of the tantrics believe that sex is only one vehicle to this transcendence, this kind of getting lost in time and space, this merging of people.
Sex is a form of meditation, if you will.
It's one vehicle, so it's easiest for people to do it, you know, without any problems, especially when you're younger, and through the body. But mm-hmm. that you can get to that state of bliss or ecstasy, you know, or orgasm, other ways too. And so as you develop your other energies in your body, you could get there through breath and sound and movement, you know, so you could get there other ways, and totally by yourself too. So,
well, I want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Mitchell Tepper, who's a sexologist, and his website is Mitchell Tepper, MitchellTepper.com. And we've been talking about really accessible sex, and we're talking about it with people who either have disabilities or chronic conditions, and trying to make this point, if no other, that sex is your right, and it's one that is accessible no matter what level of disability or what level of circumstance you're at, and whether you're single and need to identify someone, or whether you are in a couple's relationship that needs to be reinvigorated or reinvented because of an illness or a problem that's come up. It's all doable, but it's going to require you to do some work and reframe it, because you're going to have to get first the information that comes from various websites or from information that you find from, for instance, aasect.org or other sources that are reliable. You're going to have to find the right kind of person to work with you, to help you, to be your counselor, your guide through this window of time, that you're going to have to do some effort to explore your medications that you take to see if they're an impact. You need to schedule times that really work for you and your partner so that you're in a position to be most energized and most present in the circumstance. If you have problems with pain or other kinds of issues of controlling bowel or bladder, you want to treat it like an interview from the standpoint you want to get yourself ready and spiffed up, ready and ready to go, so that when you get there, you're making your best presentation. And this is one of these times when you and your partner are going to get the most out of it that way. And you want to be able to find positions that work and alternative sexual experiences that are positive and pleasurable mutually or alternatingly in a way that makes your life happen. And if you do these things, which is really a mouthful of things, but the goal is is to reach the possibilities, and the possibilities are endless. So is there anything that you want to – any points you want to make or say? Or
wow, no, I think you just did such a wonderful job summarizing our discussion. I'm going to give you an honorary Prophet of Pleasure
oh, wow.
title.
Wow, you know? join me. That's
join
got me. My breath going faster, and I can feel the blood in my bracing and my et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, once again, been a pleasure talking with Dr. Mitchell Tepper. Dr. Mitchell Tepper is a sexologist. His site is mitchelltepper.com. And stay well, everyone. Remember, it's better to stay well than to get well.